start first by talking about the in-court...
Is that thin evidence on retrial because of the video? Because he was convicted the first
time. He was convicted. The evidence, there was substantially less evidence before the jury at the time of the second trial. So looking at the evidence the jury had, any erroneously admitted evidence about the perpetrator would have affected the outcome of how that jury deliberated based upon the lack of evidence, the limited amount of evidence that he was involved at all.
So in the first trial, there was the jury had the video from the motel. The jury had the clothes, correct?
Yes.
And they did not have either of those pieces of evidence before them in the second trial.
That's true.
So what is the touchstone here for the unfairness, I guess would be the term I would use? Is it a violation of an ethical rule? Is it a due process violation? Is it an improper vouching? In reading the brief, it wasn't clear to me what the standard would be or what the rule would be.
Well, you know, ultimately, I think it comes down to due process and, you know, common law fundamental fairness that the courts protect and that the criminal justice system is there to provide. The in-court identification, which was really a memory of having been in court 5 years earlier, seeing Mr. Sakawi at counsel table charged with this crime, and then coming in 5 years later and saying, well, I now remember seeing him, and I believe that he was the person in there. In the court, who I saw a year before in the motel lobby, and
but there was no real objection to the clerk testifying to that, was there?
There was an objection. Yes, there was a pretrial objection because she had, for the first time during an interview the week before this 2013 trial, that was when she'd first said, "Oh, by the way, I remember him. I don't necessarily remember him now, but I remember when I was in court 5 years ago, and I saw him there."
So she doesn't really identify him in court at the second trial. She says she identified him at the first trial, but wasn't asked to identify him.
And had never told anybody about that. From what we know now about how memory works is that people are shaped in their good faith and honest belief that their memories are shaped by information they get later. So when she was in court in 2008, and actually in court in 2013, knowing that Mrs. Sakawi had been charged and she was back for a new trial, having that conviction having been overturned, presumably she would know that has to affect her memory and shape it in unconscious ways. And it's not that she was lying. She was honest in court in 2013. I don't recognize him now. But that her memory, for reasons beyond her control, is reshaped.
Turning to the testimony of the prosecutor, following up on Judge Trickey's question, what is your argument related to the testimony of the prosecutor concerning what she saw previously in the video? Is that due process? Is that an RPC violation? Is that vouching?
Well, I think it ultimately is a due process argument based upon the number of reasons that she shouldn't have been testifying. And one is that her memory would be tainted by her close review of this otherwise suppressed evidence. That even the prosecutor, in good faith, no one is able to just pull out their memory. She had clearly relied on those clothes that she held up before the jury and in closing argument repeatedly refers to as these clothes show you, in comparison to the videotape, that he was the person.
And so once again, because the court suppressed introduction of the clothes as evidence, that also implicates the prosecutor's testimony?
It does. Because the suppression requires removing the taint of the illegal excused evidence, and she's testifying, her memory is based upon legally excused evidence.
Evidentiary hearing, and didn't the prosecutor testify, I watched the video 10 to 15 times? So the court allowed her to testify, and there was other testimony from the two police officers about what they saw in the video. So is the prosecutor's testimony cumulative?
Well, we don't think she was a necessary witness, but that doesn't mean her testimony wasn't particularly prejudicial, because you have someone who was a prosecutor who comes to court with that enhanced reliability of being someone who the jury knows, you know, is a government, you know, a quasi-judicial official, really, who, you know, with that good faith that comes in, and she's, her testimony would be particularly relied on by the jury, so they didn't need her to testify.
Is there a particular case you rely on for the impermissible calling of, I know you cite a lot of cases, I'm just talking about a particular case that's analogous to the situation we have here, or most analogous?
I wasn't really able to find a case that was analogous, really, to these circumstances, because it is obviously a very unusual set of circumstances, because the prosecutor had, you know, obviously had also been allowed access to privileged attorney-client information, which is another reason why she shouldn't have been involved in the case. And then, you know, it's very rare for anyone to call a prosecutor as a witness, for the reasons like vouching, you know, for the vouching. The vouching case law demonstrates why, you know, juries may have an outsized reliance on things a prosecutor says. So they're not supposed to vouch for things, but when she's testifying, and then when the prosecutor in closing argument here says, you names her specifically as someone who was here telling you that Mr. Sakawi is the guy who committed this crime, that ultimately leads the jury to rely on her testimony, which never should have been admitted. It wasn't necessary to their case, and Mr. Sakawi's not really able to cross-examine her as would other witnesses.
I think it was necessary for purposes of describing why the jury wasn't seeing the video again.
They had detectives testifying. They, in fact, even had an expert, a computer person, come in and talk about how they tried their best. It was just some obscure software, and they couldn't play it. But they had, you know, a number of them had seen it. And the police officers who had never seen the illegally seized clothes came in, and they testified about the video and about, you know, what Mr. Sakai would look like when arrested.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Amy Meckling, Deputy Prosecutor, appearing on behalf of the State of Washington. The trial court's decision here to allow Prosecutor Klein to testify at Sakawi's second trial was not an abuse of discretion, did not deprive him of a fair trial, because she had relevant and probative information and evidence to provide, and she had had no further involvement in the prosecution of Mr. Sakawi after his original convictions were reversed in the personal restraint petition.
So you say abuse of discretion. That would imply it's an evidentiary decision.
It is an evidentiary
decision.
It's
purely evidentiary, no other considerations at all?
No, and that's why I mentioned also that it did not deprive him of a fair trial, because the defense argument here is that her testimony was a violation of due process, although I think there is some confusion on the part of the panel and myself as well exactly what the foundation or what the touchstone of the argument is, because it's not clear from the briefing, and it's still not clear to me today exactly what the argument is. There's a number of points that are brought up. For instance,
Before you get to the points, what was the relevant and probative evidence, separate and aside from the problems related to the video?
The video. So she's testified, this is what she testified to. She testified that there was this video surveillance, obviously, that she had seen 10 to 15 times, and she had viewed it far more than any other witness, because the police officers who testified that they viewed it at the time of the crime, at the motel. They viewed it one, maybe two times, and that was it. And their descriptions were quite vague. The detective testified that she had viewed it one or two times. The prosecutor had seen it 10 to 15 times and clearly had more detail and more memory of what was in it. So she testified about what the video depicted in terms of both the general description of the suspect and the victim and what occurred. She also described that Mr. Sakawi was present at the 2008 hearing in which Ms. Wood had testified, thereby providing this link for Ms. Wood's identification, because Ms. Wood didn't say, "I identified that man in 2008 and point to Mr. Sakawi." She said, "When I was here in 2008, I was really surprised that nobody asked me whether I could identify anyone."
I think what we're concerned about is the testimony related to the clothes.
Okay, to the clothes. So I'll talk about that. Her testimony was very specific in the pretrial hearing about what her memory was based on the video versus what her memory was based on her actual viewing of the clothes. There weren't any photographs of the clothes that were taken into evidence, so she never saw any photographs. She testified so that it wasn't like there was photographs in her file that she could refer to, you know, whenever she wanted to. She saw the clothes one time in a defense evidence viewing with the detective, and she saw them in court, and that was it.
With regard to the trial court's finding that her viewing of the clothes did not, I guess, taint, for lack of a better word, her in-court testimony, is that a factual finding or a legal conclusion, and how would we review that?
I think it's a factual finding, and you review it for substantial evidence. She had plenty of evidence to make that finding, too. If you read the record, you know, Ms. Klein was very clear that when she saw the video, sees this, you know, nondescript sort of black jacket of some sort with some sort of red top underneath it that appeared to her to have, like, white lettering, but she wasn't sure whether it was lettering or not. And then the hood of the jacket appeared to have something white either stuck inside of it or the hood was white. She didn't know. That was it. And then she testified, when I actually saw the clothing, then I can see that the actual hood of the jacket is lined with the sheepskin fur, and so I know that's what the white thing was. And she testified that I could also see that when you the red top has wording on it, and it sort of, you know, matched up with what she had already seen. But it was much more specific when she saw the clothing. What she testified to in the second trial in front of the jury, so what the jury heard, was this sort of nondescript black jacket with maybe something white in the hood and a baseball cap.
How is that different from what the officers testified to?
Well, there was no, first of all, Mr. Sakawi wasn't, to anyone's memory, arrested with a baseball hat on. So there was no hat. And the hat, so this, the hat is only seen in the video. There was never any hat taken into evidence. The description from officers was...
Okay, you're getting to the officers.
Yeah, so they testified there was no hat. That was the first part of it. And then the officer who discovered Mr. Sakawi in the bushes testified that he was wearing a black jacket with red stuff on it and that he wasn't wearing a hat. And then Officer Shields, who actually took the clothing into evidence but also met with Mr. Sakawi at the hospital while he was still wearing the clothing, testified that he was wearing a black jacket with either a red hoodie or sweatshirt. So all of these descriptions are fairly...
Why then would we need to have Prosecutor Klein testify?
Because when you don't have the actual video itself and all you have is a description of what's seen on it, and the best evidence in this case is the fact that Mr. Sakawi was found 30 feet from the other suspect, essentially, that has the phone in the pocket, wearing this similar clothing.
But the police officers could have testified to that.
I understand that.
So what did the prosecutor, what was the specific evidentiary reason to allow the prosecutor to testify if you had the police officers that could testify to all of that?
Again, when you don't have the video, as many consistent descriptions as you have of what was seen on the suspect at the time of the crime is important. One officer who sees the video one or two times is not the same as a prosecutor or anybody who watches it 10 to 15 times and provides a very consistent description.
So
what Mr. Hines argued in closing argument. I mean, what he argued specifically was, and it's not vouching, if you take it in context, he's saying that nobody viewing this video, not the officers, not Klein, or even these jurors, had they been able to see it, would have been able to identify, anybody in the video, because the facial features were, it was poor quality. So he says, all of these people who saw it, although they give general descriptions of body type and clothing, they're all very consistent. And that consistency is important because you no longer have the video for the jurors to see themselves.
Given that, though, that the prosecutor's testimony was more detailed because of she had more chance to view the video, she had a slightly more detailed recollection of the clothing, it seemed to me, isn't there a danger that the jury is just going to give more weight to that by the nature of her office?
Well, I mean, that's a concern that is addressed through cross-examination. I don't think that affects the admissibility of the evidence. It might affect its weight, certainly, and that's something that Mr. Sakawi inquired into. And he specifically asked her on cross-examination, one of the first questions out of his mouth were, well, when you were here and when you handled this case and you performed the same role as Mr. Hines is performing today, in other words, you were prosecuting him for this crime. He elicited that in cross-examination, and then I don't recall whether he argued it specifically, but he certainly could have, and that's an obvious sort of argument to make. She's the prosecutor. Of course she's biased. But as the case law makes clear, I think it's specifically bland, arguments relating to bias of the prosecutor witness are best addressed through cross-examination and argument, not by suppressing the evidence.
But didn't the Bland court find that they didn't really have to deal with the issue because the witness who testified there was testifying as a social worker and not as a prosecutor in that case?
That may have been. I don't think that distinction is a distinction with any real substance, frankly. There's no rule that excludes the prosecutors from being witnesses. The ethical rule that allows the court in its discretion to disqualify a prosecutor from litigating a case if he or she is a material witness presupposes that a prosecutor can, in fact, be a witness. So there's nothing, and there's no requirement that her testimony be unobtainable elsewhere. Certainly that's a factor to consider in whether or not you should, you know, allow, if her testimony is merely cumulative and provides nothing else, then certainly the court in its discretion can exercise that and say, well, I think that the jury may place too much weight on your testimony, I'm not going to allow it. But the fact that, that's not a requirement.
Well, your argument here is that it was cumulative, but it was important to admit it because it was consistent.
I don't agree that it was cumulative, and I don't mean to mince words with you, Your Honor. I think that it was consistent, and that was extremely important. I think she provided more detail than the other witnesses. I think that's clear from the record. I don't believe it was merely cumulative. And certainly the fact that she had viewed this video 10 to 15 times was not cumulative. No one else had viewed it that many times. And that alone, I believe, made her testimony admissible.
Briefly, in the time you have remaining on the in-court ID, doesn't Perry versus New Hampshire sort of limit what we can review in terms of a due process violation?
I believe so, and I, you know, I have 20 seconds, and I could spend an hour talking about this. But if you don't have any impermissibly suggestive identification procedure that's done by state actors, due process simply isn't implicated. So the test that we have in Washington and everywhere else, or most other places, is that the court first considers whether it's impermissibly suggestive and whether it was state involvement. And if not, you don't reach the reliability factors. He seeks to condense that into one single step, and I think that's untenable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 3 minutes.
Thanks. I wanted to just say there were four officers, Okart, Gallagher, O'Neill, and Shields, who all testified about either seeing the video or seeing Mr. Sakawi at the time of the incident.
But none of them were as specific as Prosecutor Klein?
Yes. I think that is fair to say, although it was all consistent, as was Ms. Woods. There's this black and red jacket, and no one can really say what's black and what's red other than Ms. Klein, who had watched this grainy videotape, but also held up these clothes repeatedly during her closing argument and said, these clothes show you that they're the same thing in the video, and urged the jury to look at those clothes carefully.
So are you arguing then that the court erred in making the finding that her testimony was not tainted by knowing about the clothes?
Yes, that it was manifestly unreasonable for the judge to say that she could testify solely from having seen the video, given the way we know that memory works. And in that case, I just filed yesterday as a supplemental statement of authority from Massachusetts, which was just decided on Monday. They talk about generally accepted principles of eyewitness identification, and then there's a near consensus in the community making so generally accepted this very notion that memory just doesn't function that way, and it is unreasonable for the judge to have thought so.
But if I read those Massachusetts case correctly, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, or Supreme Judicial Court, I'm not sure the correct title, sort of came up with a rule. They didn't seem to relate it to due process. They just said, from henceforth, no in-court ID without good cause. And so it didn't seem to be tied into a constitutional provision or an evidentiary rule.
The basis that they cited, it is their highest court in Massachusetts, was common law principles of fundamental fairness. And that was what they pulled that from.
Which is different than due process?
I think it's the same generally, our notion that the courts are protecting the fairness of trials. And in the Allen case, Justice Madsen noted that courts are not here to tolerate convictions that are the result of unreliable identifications. That is part of the court's role. And just speaking briefly to the Perry case, our first argument is that prosecutors are state actors. So when prosecutors bring someone to court and arrange that suggestive circumstance of, you know, and are going to premise their case on that in-court identification, having never previously asked the witness to identify him in a non-suggestive fashion, that Perry does contemplate that, and so does the 14th Amendment, and if not, our state constitution does and should protect the reliability of our trials by giving the jury that kind of reliable evidence and not letting them rely on evidence that is otherwise found to be unreliable. We ask you to reverse Mr. Sakawi's convictions.
Thank you.